So thanks a lot for the opportunity to speak here. And I should also thank ITP for the opportunity to be here for 1 month. It's such a nice place. So what I will describe, the title is Grasp the Giant Magnon. I will, hopefully by the end of the introduction, it will be clear what the giant magnon is. And I will describe the wrapping phenomena in the last 2 points. So I'm working in the context of EDS-CFT, and I'm exploring the integrable structures in N equals 4 and in the dual theory, the strings in EDS-5, process 5. I'll be always working at strictly infinite N, and I will be focused from the gauge theory point of view in single trace gauge invariant operators. From the point of view of strings, I have just free strings in EDS-5, process 5. So in N equals 4, super Young-Mills, then, the natural operators to consider, to start considering, are the single trace operators, O, B, which are given by a trace of a product of fields. So say I can have, for example, two scalars phi 1, I can have a fermion, then I can have a scalar psi 2, another psi 1, say two covariant derivatives acting on psi 1, etc. So I have some operators, there are covariant derivatives, fermions, six scalars. And the covariant derivatives themselves have some directions, but let me omit some indices. And then, in this four-dimensional field series, so this is a four-dimensional CFT, I can start computing correlation functions. And in principle, if I compute some correlation function of say, this operator, OB of X, so all these points are in the same position, with another field, I obtain some infinites, which come from the loops, and I have to renormalize the operator. So what I should do, I should have some OA. This index B stands for the ordering of these fields. So, of course, there is a this is already a one-dimensional object because these are matrices, and therefore I cannot exchange the order of the objects. So what I should do, I should renormalize my operator, OA renormalized, which will be equal to some matrix, which let me parameterize as e to the h log of the cutoff AB, acting on the bare operator. That is, I pick the bare operators. They should have all the same number of fields because they should have the same classical dimension. I mix them among themselves in such a way that this linear combination of operators is finite when I put it in correlation functions. And then, once I have done this, now, if I pick the renormalized operator, and if I compute correlation functions of these renormalized operators, I get basically, since the theory is conformal, the two-point functions are simply given by a simple power law. And this delta is the anomalous dimensions of operators, which, it's easy to see from the renormalization group, are related to this mixing matrix in a trivial way, namely H is an operator which acts on these operators into the space of operator, mixes all the operators. The eigenvalues of the operator H are the anomalous dimensions. The eigenvectors of the operators give me what are the good linear combinations that I should consider. So this delta, the set of delta, are the eigenvalues of this operator H. So now, what people did, what we can do, which is at the moment just a notational point of view, is to say that I look at this operator as being some spin chain. It is a one-dimensional object because it's a product of matrices whose order is important. So I can look at this operator as being some spin chain. Say phi 1, let me draw as arrows up. Then fermions, let me draw, for example, as orange arrows down. Then I have another scalar phi 2. I don't know how to draw it. Like this, say another phi 1. Then two covariant derivatives. Covariant derivatives let me put a ball, for example, with a 2 on top. Then another phi 1, etc. So, by definition, this is just notation. This is just a way I want to look at this state as being some spin chain. Now, if I do this, then automatically, by definition again, H, which is an operator which mixes me these states, is an operator which acts on spin chain states and gives me spin chain states. And I want to find what are the good linear combinations of spin chain states. So by definition, H is an Hamiltonian of a spin chain. And the symmetry of this Hamiltonian, the symmetry which rotates the fields, is the symmetry of N equals 4, which is PSU 2, 2/4. So how in practice do I compute this Hamiltonian? I have this operator, which I represent, it's a single trace, so it's useful to put, say, like this, if I have four fields. And then I put some probes here, and I have to see what are the possible divergences. Say, for example, there is this diagram where I use the commutator of the scalars, which is in the Lagrangian. I get here some divergences, A log of the cutoff, which means that this operator minus A log of the cutoff times the same operator with the counter term. It's finite. This operator would be what I call this O renormalized. So in computing this way, I understand what's the mixing of this operator, and this by definition defines me an Hamiltonian. Now notice that since I'm working at n equals infinity, this Hamiltonian I computed here to one loop, it is nearest neighbors. To two loops, it will be next to nearest neighbors. To n loops, it will be a long-range Hamiltonian. So we will be working with long-range Hamiltonians with 2,2/4 symmetry. Now, recently, there was a change in the way of thinking. So this stuff which I described here was found by Minahan and Zarembo, at least for the first sector. So what they understood was this mixing, that it was an integrable Hamiltonian for when you have only two types of when you have only the scalars. And they understood it to one loop. Then people generalized not only to all the full sector, but also to more loops, and integrability persists. Now, there was a change in paradigm from the Hamiltonian to the S matrix, which is as follows. We start by considering now a subset of this type of operators, which are long operators. So a long operator means an operator where I have lots of spins up, and then I have some other field, say a covariant derivative, then lots of spin up, then a fermion, and then lots of spin up. And then I look at such long operators, and I say that the spin ups for me are like a vacuum, and on top of this vacuum, I have the other fields, which are the particles, which are called magnons. So you see already that one of the words of the title appearing. So magnons are the particles in the spin chain. So now you want to understand what states, this family of states, these long operators, so the number of fields is denoted usually by J. You want to understand what are the linear combinations which diagonalize the Hamiltonian. You want to find the eigenvectors. So what you do is you make some plane wave. Say you put this field in position n and you put a plane wave e to the I k n. And you make plane waves, say here you have two fields, you would put a plane wave with two momenta, and then you have incoming momenta, a term with incoming momenta, a term with outgoing momenta, with momenta reflected, and the coefficient which relates the two terms in the wave function is by definition the S-matrix. So now, from the Hamiltonian, the natural object to consider is the S-matrix, where we have, say, a covariant derivative scattering with a fermion to give, for example, a scalar and a fermion again. So it's an object with indices. So it's a matrix. And this matrix now, notice that the symmetry is now not 2,2/4. Now, if I want to understand what are these particles here, what is the symmetry which rotates this ball into this arrow into the square? Now it's a smaller symmetry. It's the symmetry which kills the vacuum, basically. So it's the symmetry which rotates the particles among themselves. And if I analyze, if I see what are the generators which kill the vacuum, what is this residual symmetry, to see what's the symmetry of this S-matrix, I see that this S-matrix is TSU2/2, that it's extended, but this I will not be mentioning, squared. So this is the symmetry of the particles.
So, Petra, are these excitations well separated?
These excitations, here I'm considering always these operators where the excitations are well separated. And I will mention in a minute what well-separated means. But well-separated, I can already say, means that, for example, if I consider this operator, I can have one loop, I can have two loops, I can have three loops, but that's four loops. This field starts interacting with itself. So you start having the operator, and the interactions start wrapping around the cylinder. And these are the wrapping interactions which I will be focused on the last part of the talk. So are these new interactions, which we will see they are not taken into account yet. So we changed from Hamiltonian to an S-matrix of smaller symmetry. And now the Hamiltonian is a part of this symmetry here. Now, what's remarkable about this change is that symmetry alone fixes, at least to some extent, the form of the S matrix completely. So what you do, you impose that the S matrix commutes with the several generators that you have. That's what it means, that the S matrix is 2/2 symmetric. And you write all your possible tensor structures, you start making relation between the several coefficients, and you find out that the simple fact that they transform under this symmetry, it fixes the S matrix completely up to an overall function. But all the matrix structure is fixed. Then there is an overall factor. And this overall factor is now believed to be conjectured based on some crossing symmetry assumptions, and people now believe that they know completely the S matrix. And, as I told, the Hamiltonian is contained in the algebra, so they believe also they know the dispersion relation of these particles. So the dispersion relation, if I have a state with one particle up to m particles, then the anomalous dimension is equal to the sum, and the dispersion relation takes a simple square root formula, which was derived already in many ways, 1 plus... I always forget here. Lambda over pi. Let me check the factor. Oh, no left
It depends on conventions. So.
Okay. Probably lambda over pi is the most popular one. Sine square of pj over 2, where pj are the momenta of p1 p up to pm. So I sum over m. So if you give me a state with momenta p1 up to pn, I compute the anomalous dimensions, which remind that this is a single trace operator, by using this formula. And now, how to find the momenta? Then is the question, how to quantize the momenta? And the quantization of momenta is done by the Bittan-Zatz equation. The meaning of Bittan-Zatz equation is quite simple. It means I have some wave function. Now I pick one of the particles, say this ball. I carry it around this ring. I did not mention this is a ring because I'm speaking about traces in gauge theory. So there is cyclic invariance. So all these states are periodic. I pick this operator, I carry it around the ring, and when I go back, I should find the trivial phase for the wave function. So this basically means that I should solve the following diagonalization problem. I have exponential, I pick one of the particles, I carry it around the ring, so I get a phase which is trivial, just the pre-propagation. This is J, the length of the spin chain. And then each time the particle meets another particle, so meet product, I get an extra phase, S matrix, Pj, Pk. This should be trivial, means that I act on the wave function, and I should get zero. So this is a problem of diagonalization. I have here a complicated matrix, which leads in the tensor product of all these particles. And in principle, if, as I told you, people know this S matrix, which was fixed by symmetry completely, they just need to solve these fit equations, quantize the momenta, plug them in this form, and they have a spectrum of the gauge theory. Now, first, so this equation, they should be diagonalized. You should remember that this is a matrix. So in the process of diagonalization, we have to introduce auxiliary variables. And at the end, this turns out to be a system of 7, which is the rank of 2,2/4. 7 equations, which are polynomial equations. They look quite scary. But we should keep in mind that they replace the computation of all the Feynman graphs. So the problem is reduced to solving some polynomial equations whose explicit form I'm not writing. Now, there are some dots here. And the dots here come, it's one of the drawbacks of this change in paradigm from Hamiltonian to S matrix. So what happens, as you anticipated, is that indeed we need long operators for all this to be valid. I need to have S matrix, I need to have some asymptotic region where I can measure the energy. So I need to have this notion of S matrix. I pick the states, I'm scattering them on themselves. So if I want to compute the anomalous dimension of operator of size 10, I can go just to order 9 in perturbation theory or something like this. And if I want to be able to go beyond, I need to understand these interactions here. These interactions will be the interactions, as I told once, where the field starts interacting with itself. So graphically, I have my field and I have an interaction going around. So for example, you might wonder, this is very nice, but what you would like to compute at some point is, say, what is the anomalous dimension of the Konishi operator. Say the Konishi operator, as people usually know, is trace of phi I square, where you sum over I equal 1 up to 6, you sum over the 6 scalar. This is the simplest operator, and in principle you want to plot this function. Now, the anomalous, this is the anomalous part, I don't count the number of fields. Now, the anomalous part is also equal to the anomalous part of this operator. This is just because if I apply supersymmetry, I see that they are in the same multiplets, so they have the same anomalous dimension, and when I apply the Q generators, I change the number of fields. Where this Z and X are linear combinations of psi 1, are complex scalars. Now, this operator is indeed one of these spin chains. So this operator is spin up, then I have one X, then I have spin up, then I have another. And this is one linear combination, minus now the state that I have them close to one another. Now I want to plot this function. This is in principle what I want to do. Let me plot delta as function of g. So it's a function, it starts at 4, which is the classical dimension, and in principle, what we want is to plot such functions, to understand the spectrum of this four-dimensional gauge theory. So as I told, if you solve this Bittan-Zatz equation, you find some result, which is correct up to 3 loops, and the plot will look something like this. And then you can eventually compute it to 4 loops, which is when these wrapping interactions start to appear. And there are actually 2 computations. The plot looks more or less like this. 2 people computed. There is this Hiller and Mann, and there is a big Italian group whose names, let me put just the initials because there are many. So it's Fiambretti, Satambrogio, Sieg, and Zenon. So there are 2 computations of this result up to 4 loops. They don't agree. They are seen there. And there are lots of conjectures that people already have, some curves. Most of them lie here. This computation is very bold. It's the one which is more to the top. There is a conjecture lying here in the middle. I can tell what these conjectures are about if you want. But basically, when you start increasing the coupling at some point, around 0.3, you start seeing that these different results start appearing and the curve starts appearing, starts splitting. So these computations, compared to all these lines which I represented, some old conjectures, these conjectures were based on the Bittan-Zatz. Say, for example, trying to say, let's believe the Bittan-Zatz beyond his limit of validity, or there are many, or let's use some transcendentality principles that people had observed to try to guess what it could be. These 2 calculations, even though they still don't agree, and it's hard to check who is right, because one they use components, and this one uses superspace, and each one has hundreds of diagrams, so it's basically quite hard to see who is right. But they have something completely different in structure with all the conjecture, which is that the result for the anomalous dimension of the Konishi operator that they find is some rational number plus some rational number times zeta 3 plus some rational number times zeta 5, while zeta 5 is absent in all previous conjectures. So on these zeta 5s and zeta 3s, they were quite important in when people were trying to guess these conjectures. They relied very heavily in believing that the structure of transcendentality was preserved with wrappings, which seems not to be the case. And now, I want to move, having explained more or less what's the status from the gauge theory point of view, I want to move from the string theory side, where we will try also to understand these wrappings. So in string theory, which is a two-dimensional field theory, it is also natural to understand what these wrappings are. You have your theory, which you can define in infinite volume, two-dimensional field theory, which suppose you know how to quantize exactly this sigma model. Then when you put it in finite value, there are virtual corrections where particles go around the ring, and those particles, even if you know how to solve the theory in infinite volume exactly, were not taken into account and need to be.
So these graphs, presumably they flatten out again because there's some unitarity bound on delta, right? It's like delta has to be bigger than 1 or something.
It's just a 4 loop. You need to copy the 5 loop and then you'll flatten it.
No, at least it will. It must, right?
Yeah, but then the 6 loop, right? It's one of these things where it'll go...
There is a radius of convergence. So in principle, if you copy 3 loops, it will be 4 loops, it will go that way. So it's funny, for example, there are some operators, for example, with 2 scalars and lots of covariant derivatives, where people have now some equations which interpolate from the anomalous dimension from one side to the other. Then it's quite nice, for example, if you expand the anomalous dimension at weak coupling, you find some series with finite radius of convergence where you can understand. If you expand at strong coupling, it's not even Borel summable. It's a very bad asymptotic series. If, on the other hand, you solve numerically the equation by putting some g in the middle, then you find some perfect value, which is very nice. So if you solve numerically, you find some very nice curve for each value of g. But if you expand, you find finite radius of convergence on one side. And
why don't people just do this numerically? It doesn't look so... Is it so bad? Is it a 7 polynomial equations or something?
No, those people can. But the point is that if you solve this, say, iteratively, you solve one loop, then two loops, three loops. Then at four loops, these equations are wrong, simply. So these equations stop working at some point. Now, the operators which I'm saying, this wrapping's effect, by some reasons, are suppressed. So for those operators which I'm saying, indeed, those equations are enough to study the interpolation from weak to strong coupling. But here, if I start increasing the number of loops for these simple operators, at five loops, this equation starts being wrong, at four loops. Yeah. So now, considering strings, the picture is that I have some string, and then I have some solitons on the string, and these solitons correspond to these operators, to this, to the arrow, or to the ball. So there are several types of solitons, because basically when I'm exciting the string, I have several polarizations. I can excite an ADS mode, S5 mode, fermionic node. And the string, the size of the string is its angular momentum, which is J, when I like Kuhn gauge fix.
Calling them solitons is a little bit of an exaggeration, right? Because when you take the momentum in the world sheet really small, you think of them as particles, and the dimension being one. Right? You look at that square root formula.
Yes.
Delta minus J is 1 for P approximately equal to 0.
Yes.
So you think that those are particles because the dimension or the energy
that
they carry is small.
Okay, particles. I mean, when you analyze it from the point of view, sometimes they look like solitons. When you use some techniques of integrability, say when you relate to time Gordon, then...
Yeah, but it's just the Virasoro constraint that makes them look like solitons.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Because that relates how big these things are on the world sheet to some other quantum number.
Yeah. So there are the excitations of light cone gauge things. Of light cone gauge things. Now, and what do we want to compute then? What we want to consider is, we want to consider these excitations when I have J equal to infinity, and these are given by some dispersion relations, which is this famous square root form. 1 plus lambda over pi sine square p over 2. And then I want to consider what happens when I put this object in finite volume. This will be as epsilon infinity plus some delta epsilon. And we want to consider what is this delta epsilon. What happens when I start putting the object in finite volume? So, as you see, this object, which we understood from the gauge theory point of view, it was completely fixed by symmetry. Of course, here, when I let Kuhn fix, the symmetry is the same, right? So symmetry, you could again use symmetry to argue that the form of this form is fixed. And as you see, indeed, when lambda is very big, you have some square root lambda times something, so it's really a classical solution. So you can just see what it is. It's some solution which lives in S3. It goes from one point to the other of the equator, and it is open by some angle, which is this P. And this object, this classical object, which is not something small from the point of view of the target space, is what was called by often seen by giant magnet. So it is giant because some classical solution which is not something very small. Now, if I want to go from infinite volume to finite volume, there are normally two things that I can do in general when I have a field theory and I know how to solve the theory in infinite volume, which is the case, as I told you, and I want to go to finite volume. So one of the techniques is called the thermodynamical Ditton-Zatz, while the other technique is called the Luscher approach. Now, the thermodynamical Ditton-Zatz is good because it's exact, and it's bad because basically it's hard, and it's only for two-dimensional integrable theories. And it's particular, it's not so hard, it's medium, say, if you want to consider, for example, if you have some field theory and you want to understand what's the ground state energy as a function of the volume of the theory, if you want to, say, put some theory in the cylinder and just say what is the ground state energy, this is reasonable. But if you want to consider what we want to consider, which is you have some excitation and you want to consider what is the dispersion relation of the excitation in finite volume, then it becomes quite hard. While Luscher, what's good about it is that it is very easy to apply it. I can apply it to any theory of d-dimensions. So it's really straightforward, and it's what I want to describe at the very end. The bad thing about Luscher is that it's only the leading volume correction. So it will give me only the leading volume correction to this delta epsilon. So let me explain what's the physics behind the TVA, and then I'll move to Luscher. Any questions so far? So the idea beyond the TVA is the following. So we must have some integral theory for which I know the S matrix, and in principle I can write some Beaton Zatz. But the Beaton Zatz, as I told, is asymptotic always. It means that the Beaton Zatz is exact if the volume is big. As the volume becomes small, I start having these interactions which wrap the cylinder, and for those interactions, they are not taken into account by the S matrix. In other words, when I compute the S matrix, imagine I was computing the S matrix by summing over all the virtual processes in infinite volume. I do the computation in infinite volume. Then I put the theory in finite volume, and there are new graphs which I did not take into account in my previous computation. The graphs where particles go around. So I have some theory, and I want to compute, say, the partition function. So let me define it in the cylinder. So when I have some L here, and I have some very small temperature here. So this bit is very large. And then I just compute this partition function by integrating over the fields. Now, if beta is very small, this is basically exponential of minus beta ground state energy of L, right? Beta is very small. If beta is very big, I mean, if you pick the ground state. But this is quite tricky to compute if you put here particles, even if the theory is integral, because the volume is finite, so you don't know how to describe the particles here. What you can do is you can look at this path integral simply by looking at time and space and interchanging them and looking at this cylinder in this way. And now, of course, the subjects are the same. It's just the way how I look at the path integral. What I can think of is that I have some theory where I have particles in a space region of size beta, which was huge, and they are put in some temperature, which is basically 1 over L. Well, but this is then equal to the exponential of length times the free energy at 1 over L. So this now is length. And this is temperature. And notice that this computation here, I am perfectly allowed to do this computation. Now I have the theory where the space is infinite, so I can very well put particles here to scatter it. And I have some finite temperature. Some finite temperature just means that I should consider the entropy and just compute the free energy. Right? So if I want to compute the ground state energy of a theory at finite L, what I should do is I should consider the Mirror theory, which is the theory which I obtain when I interchange space and time, and compute the free energy at some finite temperature. And this is exact here. I can put L small, L big, whatever I want. Now, if the theories are relativistic invariant, of course, this theory and this theory, they are the same. I can just exchange space and time. But notice that I can do it if the theory is not relativistic invariant. Just that here I have theory A and here I have theory B. But if the theory B is also integral, then I can compute still the ground state of theory A by computing the free energy of theory B. Now, this was relatively simple. For the vacuum, here I put no particles, and what do? I have some free energy. So what I do is I minimize the free energy. Hard theory. I minimize the free energy, delta F equals zero, and when I minimize the free energy, I find what's the distribution of particles which live in this theory, and I find some particles here which live on this theory. So if I put the cylinder back here, what I'm studying is virtual particles which wind the cylinder, which is perfectly natural, because if I want to compute the quantum ground state energy, I'm taking into account all this sea of virtual particles. Now, what's easy to compute? So, and this is why I say this is not quite hard. This is feasible. Now, what is also feasible is if I want to consider, say now, thermal fluctuations here, if I want to consider to add a particle and say what are the thermal excitations here. But notice that this corresponds to adding some extra virtual particle here. And in our case, this is not what we want. What we want is to add a physical particle here and understand what happens when I put a physical particle going through this sea of virtual particles. But when I rotate, this corresponds here to something very non-trivial, which is some virtual particle going here and creating some ether, say, where these particles will propagate. And this technical is quite hard, and to my knowledge, it is not yet done in a systematic way. Model by model, people try to understand how to implement here basically different boundary conditions for this TVA and so on. Ultimately, when people want to fix the last details to understanding this stuff, they need normally to glue to some known leading volume corrections. And therefore, even if we were capable to do this, the Luscher terms, which will give us the leading, would be important to fix the boundary condition. So, having explained what is the physics behind TVA, let me tell you what about Luscher. Any question? I started 10 minutes later, right? Okay. So, the Luscher approach to finite size corrections is completely different. So it starts from the idea that if I have a theory where I could compute the mass of the particles exactly, say, and now if I put it in finite volume, and I want to see how does the energy is shifted when the theory goes to finite volume, what I should compute is I should see how the self-energy is shifted. Because basically when I shift the self-energy, I shift the poles in the propagator, and it shifts how the decay of the functions go. So what I should understand is, how does the self-energy change due to the new virtual processes which were not present in infinite volume? So I need to compute the correction to the self-energy when I put particles in finite volume. Now it's intuitive, and we can check that, of course, the leading processes which I should take into account are the process where I have one particle which goes around the world once. Of course, if I have two particles which go around the world each one three times, of course, it's exponentially suppressed. It's very hard to go around the world. So if I want to consider these processes, if I decompose it into one particle irreducible, it's easy to see that the new diagram which I have to consider is something like, say, one particle, and here there is a four-point irreducible diagram, plus there are basically three possibilities. I can have a tadpole-like, and I can have one like this. So I should consider this type of diagrams which correct the self-energy to understand how the mass is corrected. So now let me just give you an idea of how this goes. I find it quite nice. So say this diagram here. So what is this? So I have integral of this virtual particle. So say I have d. Let me write it d plus 1 q. Then I have some, then what should I do? I should put here a periodic propagator. In principle, what I should do is, in perturbation theory, replace each propagator by the periodic propagator, summing over all the images. To leading order here, I'm keeping just one image. So I'm basically shifting, when I have the Fourier transform, I have exponential of EKX, I'm shifting X by X plus NL, and then summing over N in all directions. So if I keep only N equals 1 and N equals minus 1, which means I go around the world to the left and to the right, I get basically cosine of QIL. I get a 2 here, and I sum over D, over the space-time dimension. This is the factor I get from this from periodizing this propagator. Then I get the usual propagator, and the particle can have some polarization B, some propagator B, with momenta Q. This is basically 1 over Q squared plus M squared. And then I have this four-point function, where I, in principle, summed everything, where I have AABB, P minus P, Q minus Q, where I put P momenta here and Q momenta here. Now what do I do? Now I say that I have isotropy, so I can basically periodize one direction. I can choose one of the directions here, so I can replace this by basically 2D exponential of I Q1L. Then I can move the contour in Q1. I can move it up to some point where this is very suppressed. And then I can drop the integral. And in the way, I pick the pole of the propagator. So this becomes integral over d minus 1 dimensional Q, dQ0. I pick the propagator, so I get the absolute value of Q1. This is now on shell. I get exponential of I. Let me put a star to denote that it's on shell. And then I get basically this gamma here, this whole consumption. And this is basically this represents where I have P minus P, Q minus Q. So basically what I did was I moved the contour and I cut this line here. Okay? Now if I do the same for all the other diagrams, moving and cutting here, and then cutting here, and cutting here, what I basically obtain is that to this one, I should add the T-channel exchange, then the S-channel, and then the U-channel. U-channel, I never know how to draw. What's the U-channel? If I cut in all these possible directions. But then this is quite nice, because from all these diagrams here, I recognize the four-point amplitude written in terms of the irreducible parts. And this is basically up to some kinematical factors, the S matrix. And the S matrix of the theory, for example, in this case, I told you that I knew. Right? So basically, what I have is, I can get the following formula. And notice that here it was d-dimensional. So, but for our case, we will get something like integral dq. Then I have some kinematical factors, which I don't care, P and Q. Then I get exponential of I, Q, L. And then I get the S matrix. Basically, I have S matrix A, B, A, B. And I sum over B. And if the loop is fermionic, I have a minus sum. Okay? So this is basically the result of this computation. And this diagram, I draw like this, like the particle here. Now, if I do it carefully, there is another term, which is basically the residue of this stuff alpha, in case there are VPS poles, which is the case here, add some bound states, and this diagram here. And this comes, if I understand this cutting properly, not only I can get poles from the propagator, but also from these couplings here. And this gives rise to some diagram, which physically is a diagram where the particle disintegrates and then joins again here. On the other side. These terms here are normally known by the F term and the mu term. And they are both given by some expression of the S matrix, which, again, is something that, as I explained, is believed to be known to all orders. So let me just tell you what we get if we compute this term. We get that the F term is given by, if I compute this integral, I can do some saddle point here or something, and the F term is given by exponential of minus j over 2g. This is the exponential behavior. And then there is a prefactor, some function, which can be a function of g and of j and of p. Notice that this delta epsilon of p will be equal to f plus mu plus subleading in volume corrections. These are the leading ones. And the mu term is equal to exponential of minus j over 2g sine of p over 2 times some other function m of g j and p. In principle, these functions, I can compute them because I know the S matrix. Okay? Any question? So people compute these functions. It's not trivial to expand. We have to analyze it carefully. And what people understand is that this F is equal to 0 plus something. Plus something of order 1 plus order 1 over square root lambda plus etc. Where this order here, each one is a non-trivial function of j and p. And this h starts at order square root lambda plus order 1 plus order 1 over square root lambda.
So Sorry, but you're interchanging between lambda and g.
Sorry, yeah. So g. So basically here I have some classical result, some one loop result, some subleading terms, and here I don't have classical result, f term starts already at one loop, and then I have subleadings. Now notice that this non-trivial functions here, this one normally dominates over this one because there is sine p over 2, so this exponential is always stronger than this one. But it is zero classically. So now it depends how I want to organize. So I have two parameters.
Oh, sorry. I was checking the sign.
I have two parameters, which is basically I have an expansion in volume, and then I have an expansion in quantumness, say in one loop, classical, etc. So if I organize in this way, I pick the exponential corrections, and then I can expand in the world sheet coupling, then the F term will only start at one loop, while the mu term starts already at classical level. So now it depends how you want to organize to say which one is leading. And for example, we computed this term here of order one, which is the first quantum correction to this giant magnet, which starts giving us some hints on how these objects behave when I put them in finite. But I will mention the result a bit later. Now, so this is a way to organize the expansion. So what we got was the two leading volume corrections, and then if we are good with working with Mathematica and with expanding in the proper way, we can in principle expand this S matrix, which is something complicated, and in principle compute these functions with a very high precision. Now, what I want to explain next is how to go a bit beyond than the leading finite size corrections, which is nice, of course, but on the other hand, I'm only able to do it classically and at one loop. So now I reorganize the series, and I pick the classical part, and I can go far in volume corrections. Then I pick the one loop, and I can still go far in volume corrections. But I don't know how to go further.
So are you going to talk about the dual interpretation? I mean,
here I'm completely already in the dual.
In the geometric, I mean.
He's doing the string already here, because it's an expansion one over square root number.
Here it's completely the thing. You see, I have two-dimensional field theory. I'm integrating over momenta of this two-dimensional field theory. I was in light cone gauge theory. Otherwise, this is not perturbation theory of n equals 4. Otherwise, the moment to the four-dimensional moment, a completely different computation, computing Hamiltonian.
But this S you get from the
or from the string. The symmetry is the same. So in both theories, you can define the S matrix. Then from gauge theory, you have some assumptions to find it completely from string and other ones, and they match. So there is a nice story where the S matrix is known for all regions.
I can't think of these as some kind of instantonic wrap thing. I mean.
No, I don't think people know how to give that interpretation. Some people are instantons might appear in some other context. Which
just because there's an e to the like area of the coupling.
I mean, square root of lambda.
It's in the opposite position, right? The square root of lambda. Because indeed, e to the minus square root lambda, it appears exactly from this non-Borel sum of stuff when you try to understand what could be the corrections, etc. Then, indeed, the exponential minus square root lambda appear, and people are trying to understand it from this point of view. So, now, what I want to consider is to organize the expansion in such a way. Let me say that I have delta epsilon, and then I have an expansion here, some non-trivial function of, say, the volume and the momenta, plus some other function, it's better to put some tilde, some other function, plus and dot. And here I don't know. Here I can go. But here, I can go way beyond this leading volume corrections. So there is an interception. There is a region where I should be able to match results. And there is a nicer region where I can hopefully learn about this stuff from the non-intersecting region. So let me now explain. How much time do I have? 20 minutes? So now I'm in the last point. And I want to explain then how to compute this classical and one loop finite set correction. So the idea is that here so far, I didn't talk much at least about integrability from the string theory point of view. I told integrability a lot from the gauge theory. From the string theory, I used the fact that people know the S matrix But this, I mean, I could know the S matrix if I was very powerful eventually. I did not need iterability. Now, but the string theory in ADS5 is interval, meaning that there is a nice formalism to understand classically and quantum, and at classically and at semi-classical level, the theory. So the idea is that if you give me some classical solution, I can map it to a Riemann surface. And that the set of Riemann surfaces will characterize the classical solutions. Well, let me explain what's the idea. The idea, and this will be useful to understand, this will be useful as a formula to understand finite set correction. I have some field which describes me the string, which depends on sigma and tau. And this field in 2.2/4. Then I pick this field, and there exists a current, A, which depends on a complex number, x. And this complex number is arbitrary. And this current is flat. VA plus A wedge A equals 0. So this current was found by Banner, Polchinski, and Reuben. And why is it so spectacular to have a flat current which depends on an arbitrary complex number x? Well, this is quite spectacular because then I can construct the cosmonomy, which is the Wilson loop around the world sheet. I have the string world sheet. And I consider basically the path order exponential of the integral over the world sheet of this current. And this object, because the current is flat, the eigenvalues don't depend where I put the loop. So the eigenvalues, which let me denote by e to the I pj, are tau independent. They don't depend where I put here this tau, this tau, this tau, this tau. Therefore, these eigenvalues define conserved charges. These Wilson loops at different taus are conserved. But since they depend on a complex number x, which is arbitrary, they define an infinite set of conserved charges. Because I have something conserved, which depends on the fields of the string, but also depends on x. So I can say Taylor expand, for example, or do something, and get an infinite set of conserved charges. Now, why is it a Riemann surface? Because basically, if I want to compute eigenvalues, I solve some characteristic equation with square root, some polynomial, which gives me some square root. So this Riemann surface, it's here, I have some P1, P2, up to P8, because it's easy to see that this matrix is 8 by 8. It's basically the 2.2/4, like SU8. Okay? So I have a nice map that if you just give me a solution, I construct this current, it's some linear combination of the current of the model, there's some way to write it. I construct the current, I construct this Wilson loop, I compute the eigenvalues, and I have some Riemann surface. Now, of course, since the Riemann surface encodes an infinite set of conserved charges, it is not surprising if I say that given a Riemann surface, I can reconstruct the solution. Of course, it is quite hard to do it. And in practice, we don't know how to do it, but we also don't do it. Now, I forgot to say something. Okay. But I will have to ask you to keep this in cache. And I will come to this in 1 second, just to tell you that, of course, if I want to study the giant magnet in finite volume, it's way simpler than this. To describe a giant magnet in finite volume, what I have is I have the string, and I pick one of the fields, which are inside S5, and I say that this field depends only on sigma minus v tau. So I put this profile to describe some fluctuation, some profile. This is one of the fields of S5, which would describe the giant magnet. Then, when the theory is like unfixed, sigma, so the world shape coordinate, lives between minus j and j. Therefore, if I put here, I have one-dimensional theory now, there's only one variable, and I can compute the soliton, and I can compute the energy of the soliton as function of this v and j, and I can compute the momenta as function of v and j. This just by integrating. Now it becomes one-dimensional, it only depends on this. I put only one of the fields, it's a consistent classical truncation, so I obtain the energy and the momentum. Then, of course, I can eliminate P and obtain energy as function of P and J. And this, if I expand now in J, I obtain precisely lambda sine P over 2, which is the classical result, and then I start getting exponentially suppressed terms. This is just putting in the action, computing what's the solution, and expanding the energy. Now, this exponential is organized in the following way. minus j over 2g sine p over 2, the same dependence that I announced that the mu term has, then they go to some power n, and then I have some an, some function fp. This is the structure. So this I can just do by plugging into the action. I can also do it using this formula in here, understanding what's the solution which is being described by this magnet, understanding to what it degenerates, but it's really overkilling and I don't know. So basically, to describe classically, this object, I know that it lives in infinite form if j is infinite, otherwise it doesn't, so I just expand and I get the value. I think conceptually it's quite straightforward. Now, to compute the one-loop corrections, what should I do? I should consider my classical solution and consider some perturbations, some wiggling. I add some quantum fluctuation. And what should I do? I expand the action, and I see what's the spectrum of the quadratic Lagrangian which I obtain when I expand. And when I have these fluctuations basically have some frequency, omega, ij, where ij is polarization of the fluctuation, and n, where n is mode number. I have a field theory, so I decompose the mode numbers. I have several mode numbers which I can excite and several polarizations. And then what should I do to compute the one loop shift, which is the correction at one loop? Delta S at one loop, I should sum over one half of these frequencies. Like if I have two harmonic oscillators, I have one half omega 1 plus one half omega 2. In this case, I have infinitely many. I should sum over all of them. So I should sum over n and over ij. And if it is a fermionic oscillator, I should put a minus sign. So this, in principle, is what I should do. And to compute these frequencies and to compute this sum, the formalism of this algebraic curve is quite useful. And the idea, what we understood with Kolya Gromov, is that... by the way, I didn't mention in the beginning. What I'm describing is work with Kolya Gromov and Sakura Shakar and Mackie, that we did. So, but what we understood was that to compute classical quantum fluctuations around some classical solution in EDS5, and in principle in any integral theory which is described by some finite gap method, this is what is called the finite gap method, what you should do is draw the Riemann surface, which corresponds to the classical solution. And then, if you want to consider the several quantum fluctuations, it corresponds to pinching this Riemann surface by adding poles to the Riemann surface. And these poles, they can unite several sheets of the Riemann surface, and the several sheets united by the Riemann surface correspond to the several polarizations of the string. So. Let me see. Okay, maybe I have time. 10 minutes, it's okay. So, how do we compute in practice this stuff? So what we do is the following. So we have our quasi-momenta. And the quasi-momenta, you have some surface. And when you go and you cross a cut, what happens to this quasi-momenta P? Well, the exponential of P, which are the eigenvalues, describes some good algebraic curve. But P appears there as exponential by P, is the eigenvalue. So eventually, when I jump on a cut which unites P on both sides of the cut jumps by an integer 2 pi n ij. Then, the physical picture that we have behind these Riemann surfaces is the following. You look at some Riemann surface, and you have, for each cut, you have the following. You can integrate P, and this defines some S, which is integral of P of x dx around the cut. This is called the filling fraction. Now I have three quantities. The filling fraction, I have this jump of P by an integer, and I have the two sheets being united, I and j. These quantities physically, they have a very nice interpretation. They are the analog in Fourier of the polarization of the mode I'm exciting, the mode number of Fourier that I'm exciting, and the amplitude of the Fourier that I'm exciting. So if you give me some Riemann surface, I see, these cuts correspond to S5, so you excited the big mode in S5. You have a cut here, which is a small cut in EDS, so you excited a bit the string in EDS. So just by looking at which sheets are connected, you understand what fluctuations, where do the fluctuations live, how excited they are by understanding what is filling fraction, and what are the mode number of the fluctuations. So how to compute the... So if you compute then the fluctuations around the magnet, means that you add some small tau and understand what is delta p, what is the change in quasi momenta, and how do you compute it? You impose, as usual in this method of integrability, here analyticity is very important, you impose that this delta p should have a pole at this position xn, should have some asymptotic behavior, which are fixed by the behavior of this current a of x, and all this analytic behavior allows you to fix completely delta p, and from delta p you can read what is the shift in energy, and you can therefore read what is omega n ij, which is basically omega ij of the position of the fluctuation. Now, let me just mention that the fluctuation, when you say I'm going to add a fluctuation with mode number 5 to this background, of course the background will tell you where the fluctuation is. And this is obvious because you add an extra fluctuation, which is like a small cut, and on this small cut, which you choose to give a mode number n, the same equation should hold p. It is just like a very small cut. So if you put p plus delta p on this new cut using this equation, you just get that pi of xn minus pj of xn is equal to 2 pi n. So this gives you where is the position of these new poles in the Riemann surface. So if you discretize this equation, the picture that you have is that you have these poles. Here this cut is made of a lot of poles, and all they interact, and when you put this pole, it back reacts a bit, it shifts a bit the cut, it also goes to a prefixed position, which is given by this, and then the energy of the solution shifts. So in this case, when you are expanding, you must find a solution with a good analytic behavior, which is consistent with the giant magnet, and what you find is that this omega are equal to the same function of xn, where xn is given by these fluctuations here. So the output of perturbing the quasi-moment around the giant magnet is the following. The fluctuation ig with mode number n is given by the same function of xn ij, where xn ij is found from solving this pi minus pj. Okay? And so therefore you see that the omega is always the same, but for each polarization you solve a different equation, so you obtain different fluctuations. Okay? Now, I just want to mention that this formula, this is often this is the case, that in this integrable context, we manage to find what is the energy as function of where the position is, and then the position is found by putting the particle in the background. And this is normally implicit, because you can't normally solve, you have some non-algebraic stuff here, and this often is explicit. And if we want to compute omega of n by expanding directly in the action, it will be absolutely painful and very hard to do. Here I can explain a bit more of the details if you want to ask me at the end. Now, we want to sum over the fluctuations, supposing we compute it. Let me just tell you what is the idea. The idea is that to sum, we replace the sum over n by an integral of cotangent of pn dn. Cotangent of pn, cotangent as poles exactly at the integers. So if I integrate with cotangent, it's exactly the same as summing. Then I have my function x of xn ij. And then I have my minus 1, the f. Now I use the fact that the mode number n of the fluctuation and the position of the fluctuation, they are connected by this equation. So when I have n, I can replace here n by p minus p over 2, this pi n. This dn, I replace p prime over 2 pi, dx. And I go from n to the position of the fluctuation. And now it's quite nice, because I don't need to know these fluctuations explicitly, because then this is just omega of x. And now you have some integral formula, and this should give the one-loop shift. And then what we can understand is that by expanding this cotangent and manipulating contours, this cotangent becomes again just one exponential, like we did with the cosine. You can see that this is exactly the Luschert term which I presented in a completely different way. This term here will be the exponential of IQL, which I mentioned, times the S matrix. And the S matrix, AV, AV, the different polarizations are played by the different IJ, which I sum. And then this term here, omega of S, were these kinematical factors, which I never wrote, of P and Q. So in this way, we were able to understand the finite size corrections from a completely different way. And what's nice about this is that in principle, if I treat this carefully, I can go to one loop to whatever order I want. So what I get the new term is when I expand to leading order. So to conclude, we have two expansions. One of them, we have two leading finite size corrections. And then we have complicated. We have two leading exponential corrections. And then we have a series in squared lambda. In another way, we pick classical squared lambda, and then we can treat the exponential correction very precisely. One loop, and then we can treat the exponential corrections very precisely. And it's, of course, interesting to understand the overlap, to check, and we made some non-trivial checks, and everything matches perfectly. It's also interesting to try to guess, to find, for example, what are the coefficients here? What are the type of exponential corrections? What kind of diagrammatics of Luscher term type diagrams could they come from? And finally, it's interesting to try, for example, to understand how to apply all this. Something which would be funny, for example, would be to say, let's try to apply this, for example, at weak coupling, for example, which would be something quite bold to do, not expand at strong coupling, but rather at weak coupling. And maybe then, for example, we would be able to select one of these plots for Kanishi. And by this funny way, which looks completely field theoretical, so it would be a way to see the world sheet appearing in N equals 4. Okay, thank you.
I have a question. You consider here for single moment case, right?
I can consider, we consider any number of magnets. We can consider any number of magnets.
Any number of magnets?
Yes.
So can you consider even dynamic giant magnets?
Yes. We can. So dynamic giant magnets are magnets which have, which not only live in S5 but live. Have two angular momenta, don't live only in the sphere, live in the sphere and all, live in the full S5. And those we can also consider. From the Bittan-Zatz point of view, instead of being just a single root, they are a bound state, a beta string, for those who know what a beta string is, a root. And here we can compute. Everything here is completely the same, because from the point of view of algebraic curve, the difference between the ionic magnet and the usual magnet is just that the branch points change position, and we compute as function of the branch points. For us, it's completely arbitrary.
And I have another question. Mm-hmm. I want to know the relation between the Hubbard conjecture and your result.
Between the?
Hubbard conjecture and your result.
Hubbard?
Yeah, Hubbard conjecture.
So Hubbard was some model which was believed at some point to describe the N equals 4 super young mills. Because Hubbard, so it's a model where you have electrons and spins. If you consider Hubbard as alt-filling, which means that the electrons, if it's repulsive, each electron will go to one side. And then if you consider what's the effective Hamiltonian, which will be SU2 symmetric by definition, so if you, it will be nearest neighbors, then there will be virtual corrections to all orders. So it will be a long-range Hamiltonian, Hubbard model, effective Hubbard model only for the spins. And it was checked that it matches precisely one loop, two loops, and three loops of the effective Hamiltonian of SU2 in young mills. And Hubbard is quite nice, because Hubbard, from the beginning, you have very good control of wrapping effects. Hubbard is some Hamiltonian where the electrons just hop, and they interact, and they don't like to be on top of one another, so it's perfectly local Hamiltonian. This effect of wrapping only appears because you are eliminating the electrons and considering the effective theory only for the spins. So if you compute the wrapping for the Hubbard model, for example, what would be the correction to the Konishi operator from Hubbard? If Hubbard was true, it will give one of those curves. It was one of the conjectures. From Hubbard, we could also ask, would we be able to reproduce, for example, what are the exponential corrections which would come from Hubbard? But it's not obvious for me, because here, when we apply this Luscher, we assume that you have a two-dimensional world sheet theory. You have some two-dimensional field theory, and then, since you believe in ADS-CFT, you believe that you can go to weak coupling. But if you have some speed chain at weak coupling, you have no, I don't think you have any two-dimensional field theory. You should have some dual theory to Hubbard, I think. See? Because otherwise, how would you set up this, at least in this way? So it is not obvious. You could imagine that you could pick the sector which is supposed to be represented by Hubbard, which is just SU2, and say, let's try to repeat this stuff, but using not the full S matrix, but the S matrix which lives in SU2, and try to understand if we get a bit of Hubbard at least. But I don't think there is any reason for it to work, because there is no world shape description in principle.
In this simpler case of the giant magnet, you said that you could also, in principle, compute these frequencies just by expanding the action to quadratic order. Can you actually do that, or it's you really need to do?
No, people. It was done. And it matches. They only computed to leading order. They didn't consider exponential corrections. So it is feasible when it's in infinite volume. And in infinite volume, you expect some trivial result because you have the square root formula, which is supposed to be valid for all lambda. So when you expand, it's 1 plus square root. So if you expand, you get square root, and then 1 over square root. You don't get any. You get no term of order 1. So what you should find is 0. And 0, here it's trivial to find. It comes when cotangent is replaced simply by 1. And then it's trivial to see that and this is always the same function. And sum of p's prime minus p prime is 0 because the model is super traceless, because it's PSU2. So here it's absolutely trivial at 0. But if you want to compute it, it's quite non-trivial, because what's nice about this formula is that if you want to consider fermionic excitations, you unite this p with this p, and bosonic is this with this. Right? So you don't have to worry about all this fermionic expansion, which is always much harder than bosons. Here, it's always very geometric, and all these fluctuations can be understood only by connecting different sheets. But basically, the computations are very similar. So for example, they had a lot of trouble, I think, to compute the fermionic. It's quite painful.
Another question?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you.